a shorter hospital stay and appeared to shed the virus, detected by PCR tests, for a shorter period of time. Dr. Hugh Adler, the co-author of the study at Liverpool University Hospitals NHS Trust, said that although only one patient was involved, the result for tecovirimat was a promising signal. Dr. Hugh Adler said, "Now that we're seeing more cases unexpectedly, we think it's important to share," adding, "This is the sum total of human experience with these drugs and monkeypox so far. Britain has secured a supply of tecovirimat and is offering a smallpox vaccine to close contacts of people diagnosed with monkeypox to reduce the risk of symptomatic infection and severe illness. Sources suggest an extra 20,000 doses of the vaccine have been ordered to add to the UK stock of 5,000.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the newsline.
A 21-gun salute was performed in the honor of the Iranian president as Oman's Sultan Haitham bin Tariq received Ebrahim Raisi, who was on a one-day visit to the Persian Gulf country. The high-ranking delegations representing the two countries held discussions before the meeting between the two heads of state was held. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, was also among the high-ranking delegation. He met with his Omani counterpart, Saeed Badr al-Busaidi, on Monday. The Iranian president said dialogue and cooperation among regional nations would create security, noting that the presence of foreign forces not only won't serve to secure the region, but will threaten peace too.
I think first and foremost, it's important to highlight that it's significant that the first visit for the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, to the to the neighboring countries is to Oman. Oman is renowned as the Switzerland, if you like, of the region, a country that enjoys good ties with everyone, a country that tries to stay neutral, a country that tries to be the facilitator and mediator in a number of contentious issues. And Oman has strived to maintain these ties, whether it's with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with UAE, with Qatar, across the entire spectrum. And this is what leads many to believe that this visit by Iran to Oman is testament to, of course, one, to this ability of Gulf states to have good ties with Iran, and two, as a model through which Gulf states can have ties with Iran and which Iran can have ties with Gulf states, a relationship that respects the integrity of one another, and in a relationship that boosts economic ties, and a relationship that tries to promote dialogue first and foremost, as opposed to trying to settle scores.
Ebrahim Raisi further welcomed what he called Tehran and Muscat's remarkably similar stance on a multitude of matters. The Iranian president hailed the visit as one that opened a new chapter in the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman. An Iranian delegation of 50 tradesmen and economic operators traveled to Oman last week in order to pave the way for the development of economic and trade ties between the two friendly countries. Iranian Minister of Road and Urban Development, Rostam Qasemi, announced that Oman and Iran are going to sign a transportation agreement in order to establish a joint shipping line and tourist flights between the two countries. The two sides signed 13 documents and memoranda of understanding in such fields as energy, politics, transportation, diplomacy, economy, tourism, sports, and the environment. Oman is also seeking to import gas from Iran by building an offshore pipeline between the two nations.
Renew Iranian access to the global economy. And part of that, or part of the Iranian considerations, is to find a reliable partner that it trusts in order to help to facilitate that re-access or rehabilitation into the international markets. And Oman, being a country that is particularly trusted by Iran, that has good ties with Iran, that has proven time and time again, or rather this relationship has proven time and time again, to be a steady relationship between Oman and Iran. Iran wants to utilize Oman's unique position in the region, not just in terms of its strategic location, but also with regards to its international free trade agreements, with which Oman enjoys even with the likes of the United States. The idea being that Oman is a good hub through which to essentially propel Iranian goods or Iranian businesses or Iranian investments, or even to receive investments from abroad via Oman, via a trusted partner.
Iran and Oman have agreed to form a committee to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, which straddles both countries' sea borders. In 2005, both countries signed a memorandum of understanding to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, but the agreement did not materialize. This is why the Iranian president said the trip marked a departure, as the documents and memoranda of understanding will be implemented this time.
The Labour victory ends nearly a decade of conservative rule in Australia. Minister Scott Morrison conceded defeat after an election on Saturday, and the opposition Labour Party was set to end almost a decade of conservative rule, possibly with the support of pro-environment independents. Anthony Albanese says he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish. He said he wanted to unite the country. He told his supporters, "I think people want to come together. Look for our common interest, look towards that sense of common purpose. I think people have had enough of division. What they want is to come together as a nation, and I intend to lead that." Labour has secured a parliamentary majority in general elections, but Albanese may still need a coalition partner to rule. He has indicated that they'll be picked from like-minded independents. The new Labour government promises to reset Australia's relations with the world. Albanese has also promised to create stronger ties with Asia. He said, "We live in a region whereby in the future we will have China, India, and Indonesia as giants. We need to strengthen that economic partnership, and one way that we can do that is by strengthening people-to-people relations as well." Labour has promised more financial assistance and the robust social safety net as Australia grapples with the highest inflation since 2001 and soaring housing prices. The party also plans to increase minimum wages. Others will be watching closely to see if Albanese's premiership brings a less hawkish tone on China and whether ministerial meetings with Beijing resumes after a more than two-year hiatus. On the foreign policy front, it has proposed to establish a Pacific Defense School to train neighboring armies in response to China's potential military presence on the Solomon Islands. In late April, the Solomon Islands signed a security pact with China. The outgoing Australian leader was highly critical of China in particular and Asian countries in general. He had earlier accused his main opponent of being Beijing's preferred candidate. Relations between China and Australia have strained since 2018, when Australia became the first country to ban the Chinese telecom giant Huawei from its 5G wireless networks. Australia has long been known as the lucky country, partly due to its wealth of coal and gas, as well as minerals like iron ore, which have driven generations of economic growth. But it's now sitting on the frontier of a climate crisis, and the fires, floods, and droughts that are expected to become more extreme due to the rising global temperatures. Labour wants to tackle climate change with an ambitious 43% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. It also has pledged to reach emission net zero by 2050, partly by strengthening the mechanism used to pressure companies to make cuts. To speed up the transition to renewable energy, Labour plans to modernise Australia's energy grid and roll out solar banks and community batteries. But despite its net zero commitment, Labour says it'll approve new coal projects if they're environmentally and economically viable. The Conservative government had been called a climate holdout by the United Nations Secretary General after outlining a plan to get to net zero by 2050 by creating massive new gas projects. Incumbent Scott Morrison had said he would back a transition from coal to renewable energy, but had no plans to stop new coal projects.
Oh, the legacy is awful. We have the worst climate change policies on the planet, courtesy of this government. They were promoting new coal mines. A huge part of their argument was we had to open up more mines as fast as possible. So it was, you know, crashing headlong into climate change and denying any role in it. Foreign policy was a joke.
Elena Doohan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, who was on a mission to Iran from May 7th to 18th, has described U.S. sanctions on Iran as unjustifiable and inhumane.
Iran has been subjected to a broad scope of unilateral sanctions for a long period of time already. In particular, the United States has imposed economic, trade, and financial sanctions on Iran since the late 1970s, with a comprehensive trade ban since 1995, and measures to isolate Iran from the international commercial and financial system. These were expanded in mid-2000 and again after 2010, extending to many economic sectors.
U.S. sanctions also targeted Iran's central bank as well as commercial banks. The EU adopted restrictive measures and comprehensive economic and trade sanctions against Iran in 2010, supplemented by an oil embargo in 2012, and trade prohibitions involving key sectors and the freezing of assets of the Iranian central bank, Iranian shipping and shipbuilding sector, and a number of persons and entities, and restrictions on financial services, as well as exports and imports. In May 2018, Washington unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, under which the international sanctions on the Islamic Republic were eased in exchange for Tehran putting limitations on certain aspects of its nuclear activities. The U.S. then reinstated harsh economic sanctions on Iran and slapped new ones that barred countries and international firms from working with Tehran. Doohan said the U.S. continues to ban trade and investment in Iran, forcing foreign companies to leave the country for the fear of the sanctions. Many banks and businesses, including pharmaceutical and medical companies around the world, overcomply with sanctions out of fear of potential penalties. The UN rapporteur stated that overcompliance with U.S. sanctions could strip Iranians of their basic rights to health. The top UN human rights official highlighted that applying extraterritorial sanctions on Iranian companies or companies working with Iran is illegal under international law. Doohan added that the sanctions have also hampered Iran's effort to import life-saving medicines due to restrictions on banking transactions.
Human rights in Iran are severely affected by the use of unilateral sanctions. The most close to every single individual's fear is the sphere of health. The situation in Iran is the following: that some medicines are produced domestically, at the same time the raw materials are imported. And then it comes the issue again of payments, deliveries, the quality of delivered raw materials. When it comes to the rare or severe diseases, there is no possibility to deliver that.
Commenting on Iran's frozen assets abroad, the UN official said the assets estimated to be around $120 billion need to be unblocked. Duhan began her 11-day visit to Iran on May 7th, a day before the fourth anniversary of the U.S. illegal withdrawal from the JCPOA. She also referred to stalled negotiations in Vienna to bring the U.S. back to the JCPOA, urging the signatories and the U.S. to resume the negotiations. In the end, Duhan called on sanctioning states, the U.S. in particular, to abandon their policy of maximum pressure against Iran and other countries. Economic sanctions are the policy tool of choice for the United States to force countries to bend if they don't follow Washington's foreign policy objectives in many cases. Yet they have failed to bring the desired result, as they might generate some meaningful behavioral change in the targeted or sanctioned country about 40% of time.
We know that sanctions really don't work as far as convincing or having leaderships of different countries change their decision-making or their behavior. So I think over the years we've learned that nothing's going to change with the continued sanctions.
Unilateral sanctions have endangered the humanitarian situation and people's livelihood in Iran, while further affecting the vulnerable strata of the society. In sanctioned countries like Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Yemen, medical equipment is rather outdated, and they suffer shortages of medicine and protective means. One of the reasons is that payment systems are not available to buy and have medicine enter the respective countries. For instance, Iran was the scene of a serious economic and health crisis, hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. The embargo put in place by the United States threatened the lives of many Iranians. In what has been termed economic terrorism, Washington attempts to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate governments of other countries, something it has done in the case of Venezuela and Cuba. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter.
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries, so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's deputy UN representative, Dmitry Polyansky, went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February. As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but their inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In Britain, details have emerged of what appears to be another alcohol-fueled social event inside No. 10 Downing Street during lockdown, one that was seemingly not investigated by the Metropolitan Police or the official civil service investigation. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Peter Walker. The piece is titled, "The Bar is Open. Details Emerge of New Downing Street Lockdown Event." In Britain, new details have emerged of what appears to be another alcohol-fueled social event inside No. 10 Downing Street during lockdown, one that was seemingly not investigated by the Metropolitan Police or the official civil service investigation. According to the British newspaper The Mirror, between 30 and 40 staff drank alcohol and ate takeaway snacks to mark the final press briefing conducted by Boris Johnson's then spokesperson, James Slack, on 17th of November 2020. A photograph obtained by the Mirror appears to show an official setting out bottles of wine and drinks. The picture was reportedly sent to No. 10 Downing Street staff on a WhatsApp group in response to a message saying, "Time to open the COVID-secure bar." The photograph was then posted as a reply with the message, "The bar is open." Other messages reported by The Mirror seemingly demonstrate premeditation in socialising, with one referring to Wine Time Tuesday and others discussing going to buy reinforcement booze. One official said, "If someone can help me carry, I'm happy to go." The alleged event was 4 days after the leaving drinks for Lee Kane, Boris Johnson's head of communications. On Monday, ITV News obtained images showing the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, at the event, raising a glass and seeming to toast Lee Kane and make a speech. Those images have placed pressure on the Metropolitan Police to explain why Prime Minister Boris Johnson was not fined for attending the 13th of November gathering, when others at the gathering were fined. The 17th of November event was not among gatherings investigated by the Metropolitan Police and was not listed among those examined in the interim report into lockdown breaching parties by the senior Cabinet Office civil servant Sue Gray. Sue Gray's full report is expected to emerge this week. James Slack, who was a civil servant rather than a political appointee like Lee Kane, was chosen to replace Kane as head of communications. The 17th of November drinks were held to mark the last time that, as Boris Johnson's official spokesperson, he spoke to the media at the daily lobby briefings, according to reports. At that time, because of the lockdown, the briefings were being held virtually rather than in person. James Slack left No. 10 Downing Street in April of 2021. That leaving party, held in the day before Prince Philip's funeral, while indoor social mixing was still barred, was reported and investigated. He is now the deputy editor of the Sun newspaper. Evidence of what appears to be yet another social event, and one planned in advance, puts further pressure on Boris Johnson ahead of Sue Gray's findings, amid reports more Conservative MPs could be submitting letters of no confidence in the Prime Minister. If Sue Gray's full report is released this week, it would most likely be submitted to No. 10 Downing Street in the morning and published shortly afterwards, with Prime Minister Boris Johnson promising to give a statement to Parliament and answer questions from MPs later that day. No. 10 Downing Street has said that Boris Johnson would then aim to hold a press conference. A No. 10 spokesperson said, as part of their investigation, the Cabinet Office team were able to speak to No. 10 staff to establish the facts on what happened during this period. Both they and the Metropolitan Police have had access to all information relevant to their investigations, including photographs. The Metropolitan Police have concluded their investigation, and Sue Gray will publish her report shortly, at which point the Prime Minister will address the Parliament in full. Boris Johnson's former spokesperson, James Slack, was contacted for comment.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. A personality like Hamza is an unknown personality. He is not well known. The first thing that can be said about that great personality is that he is not truly recognized. Besides, the commander of the faithful, greetings be upon him, mentioned him as well in a narration in Nur al-Thaqalain, which is based on a narration in Al-Khisal. Of course, I saw this narration in Nur al-Thaqalain. I did not look it up in Khisal. In my opinion, this is an important narration. Imam Baqir alayhi salam, greetings be upon him, quotes the commander of the faithful, greetings be upon him, as saying, I made a covenant with God Almighty and His Messenger, me, my uncle Hamza, my brother Ja'far, and my cousin Ubaidah. Of course, it is a long narration and this is only a part of it. Ubaidah ibn Harith, whom no one knows, was one of the three people who fought in the beginning challenge during the Battle of Badr. Later on, he was martyred too. No one knows him. The commander of the faithful mentions him as well. me, my uncle Hamza, my brother Jafar, and my cousin Ubaidah. He says that they made a covenant with God upon an order, and we adhere to it for God and His messenger. Greetings be upon him and his household.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They agreed upon an issue and made a deal. The commander of the faithful, as well as his uncle, uncle of the Holy Prophet, that is Hamza, was 2 or 4 years older than the Holy Prophet, and he was also the Holy Prophet's foster brother. The commander of the faithful made a covenant with his uncle, his brother, and his cousin over a matter that was naturally jihad until martyrdom. It means that they would continue that path until they were martyred. Afterwards, the commander of the faithful says, "And we fulfilled it for God and His messenger. God's greetings be upon him and his household. But those three overtook me. Those three comrades preceded me in being martyred. I was left behind until God Almighty wanted me. Among the believers are men who have been true to their covenant with God. Of them, some have completed their vow and some still wait. But they have never changed in the least." The commander of the faithful quotes the Holy Quran, chapter 33, verse 23.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
survey data estimates there were 28 to 31 million uninsured people in the U.S. in 2020, and as many as 14.4 million people will be at risk of losing their health insurance coverage when the public health emergency ends. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Sakshi Odovant Ryder. This article is published under the heading Uninsured American People Are Left Behind. Here's more. After 2 years of free COVID-19 tests, vaccinations, and other healthcare resources during the pandemic, the U.S. government has run out of funding. Last month, the Biden administration wrote a letter to Congress asking lawmakers to provide $22.5 billion to keep the funding programs running across the U.S. Without the additional funding, it will leave Americans unequipped to deal with a future surge, the letter read. Since January 2022, more than 60 million households across the U.S. have ordered free at-home COVID-19 tests and had access to free testing sites across 21,500 locations around the country. U.S. residents also received free vaccinations and booster shots at 90,000 locations across the country. Moreover, areas populated by communities of color and low-income families have the highest demand for federally funded COVID-19 care. Those who don't use the clinics offered by the government typically go to hospitals, pharmacies, or health clinics for COVID-19-related services. But without the U.S. government funding, people without health insurance have limited options for seeking care and are forced to look for community-based care options, find providers willing to absorb the bill or pay out of the pocket. In the administration's letter to Congress, officials said it will be too late if Congress waits until there is another surge to provide funding. The letter also addresses several consequences arising from the lack of sustained funding, some of which include not having enough booster shots, a lack of funding to research additional vaccines that could provide protection against future variants, scaling back preventive treatments for the immunocompromised individuals and being blindsided by future variants. Not only will the lack of funding affect currently infected individuals in the U.S., but it also increases the possibility of a spread, putting more of the population at risk, said Dr. George C. Benjamin, the executive director of the American Public Health Association, adding, "This can raise the chance of more threatening variants becoming widespread." Despite repeated requests, additional COVID-19 resources haven't been approved. Instead, Republican senators are asking the administration for a detailed account of how the previous round of funding was spent. Without government funding, the cost for a COVID-19 test can run from between $20 to $850, with $127 being the median cost. There has recently been a reduced demand from citizens who can no longer afford to pay for COVID-19 tests and other healthcare resources out of pocket, which has made it increasingly difficult for some testing sites to operate. As a result, many states and healthcare organizations have resorted to shutting down. New Hampshire closed all state-managed COVID-19 vaccination sites at the end of March, stating vaccination numbers were high enough.
In San Diego, officials closed the Jacobs Center vaccination site because of a decline in requests for testing and vaccination, and instead opened up mobile clinics. For now, they are still offering tests free of charge despite federal funding running out. Embry Health, a leading COVID-19 testing provider in Arizona, recently announced it would suspend testing at 60 sites and asked individuals without insurance to pay $100 for COVID-19 tests and $200 for rapid PCR tests at the remaining locations. Embry was paying for the uninsured to get tests after the government funding stopped on March 22, 2022, but as of April 2nd can no longer afford to do so, the company said in a statement. CDR Health, a Florida-based company that offered COVID-19 tests to nearly 15,000 people a day during surges, has also closed down all 30 of its free testing centers due to lack of funding. Survey data estimates there were 28 to 31 million uninsured people in the U.S. in 2020, and as many as 14.4 million people will be at risk of losing their health insurance coverage when the public health emergency ends. So while paid testing will continue to be available, it won't be affordable or accessible for everyone, especially for marginalized communities who already face systematic healthcare bias. In the U.S., communities of color and low-income families accounted for a disproportionate number of COVID-19 cases and deaths, and experts say the lack of funding will further widen these health and economic inequities. Low-income communities and uninsured individuals, which often includes communities of color, are at the greatest risk because they will not have the financial means or insurance protections to cover vaccinations, testing, and healthcare if the federal government runs out of money to pay for them, Benjamin said. A majority of the U.S. population has received their COVID-19 vaccination doses by now. Data from Bloomberg's COVID-19 vaccination tracker shows 567 million doses have been administered as of April 13th. This may partially explain why fewer people are visiting vaccination centers, but experts warn this does not mean the pandemic is over or that there is no more need for doses or testing. Benjamin said if the BA2 variant causes big outbreaks or there is a new variant spreading, we will not be prepared for another surge of infections without federal funding. Without the required funding, the U.S. government is unable to purchase further life-saving monoclonal antibody medicines or provide boosters, shots, and other variant-specific immunizations, said Lyle Solomon, a principal attorney at Oakview Law Group. Solomon added, there will be a gradual reduction in the money available to pay doctors and other healthcare providers who treat those uninsured. Institutions like these, healthcare providers, will need to absorb the cost of uninsured patients or turn them away, which will widen the gap in access to necessary care. Not having access to free tests and vaccinations will only reduce the number of people getting the shot, which will become a major problem if cases increase again or if a new variant arises. Benjamin said, we are still not at the optimal level of vaccination, including booster shots.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the World with Reporters.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says the country's air defences shot down a spy drone operated by Saudi Arabia with a locally made surface-to-air missile. Sariya says the aircraft was carrying out hostile acts in Yemeni airspace in violation of the UN brokered truce, which came into effect on April 2nd and expires in days.
A combat drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition that was flying over Sana'a was shot down and fell here on the Ruwaishan crossroad. The Saudi-led coalition continues to violate the truce, and unfortunately the United Nations has not taken any action to protect the truce that it sponsors.
Local media say three civilians were killed and three others were wounded after the drone crashed in a residential area in Sana'a. In the wake of the incident, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation Mohammed Abdusalam says the Saudi-led coalition is responsible for a possible breakdown of the peace process. The negotiating team says the UN should hold the coalition to account for its actions.
In the face of all these violations and delays in implementing the terms of the armistice, the United Nations must hold the obstructing party that violates the terms of the armistice fully responsible. The United Nations cannot impose the specific sanctions on any of the parties, but it can at least condemn the violations. Therefore, the United Nations must take a positive attitude and condemn any party that violates the armistice that it sponsors.
The two-month truce mandates a nationwide ceasefire. Under the agreement, the coalition must also allow fuel ships to enter the port city of Hudaydah. However, the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly ignored its obligations.
The new violation of the UN brokered truce once more demonstrates how Saudi Arabia is blocking a political solution in Yemen by its repeated breaches. People here demand that the United Nations take action and adopt a clear stance against the infringements by the Saudi-led coalition. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Rights groups warn that people are dying from lack of medicines in Afghanistan. Afghan Medicine Services Union also says that medicine supplies in the country are running low and that no medicine might be available to the patients within the next 2 months.
Afghanistan is facing an unprecedented drug shortage and a sharp rise in drug prices. These days we are supplying drugs from our stocks and reserves, and I'm afraid they will run out of medicines within the next 2 months. The situation has hit our nation, health sector, and drug sellers.
The union blames the banking crisis, major cuts in global aid, and U.S. sanctions for the medicine shortage. It also called on the Taliban to allow traders to import medicine in any possible way.
Medicine shortage is rooted in different problems. Firstly, most world countries have stopped medicine export to Afghanistan since the Islamic Emirate is not recognized worldwide. Secondly, major amounts of drug importers' money is freezed and banks in New York are not cooperating. Thirdly, the Taliban have imposed certain restrictions on drug imports.
Patients in Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital in Kabul complain about their inability to provide medicines, calling for help from the international community to save their lives.
I am from the Jawzjan province. I have brought my child for treatment in this hospital in Kabul. I have been here for 5 days and I have spent all my money on services and medications. Some medicines are very hard to find and some very expensive. The doctor has given me this prescription and I am wondering how to provide the drugs.
This comes as Afghanistan is facing multiple outbreaks of diseases, including COVID-19, measles, and acute malnutrition. Afghan hospitals and clinics are running out of medicines. Doctors here say urgent action is needed to save the lives of patients. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Donetsk, the capital of the Donbass People's Republic, on a sleepy Sunday morning. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. The occasional boom of artillery or anti-air defense can be heard.
People think it's normal in the DPR, but we have no more patience to wait until it ends, to live under bombing. All my relatives and I are sometimes under shelling. Once a shell flew over my head and killed a woman nearby. It's possible to live here. I was born here, and I suppose I will die here too.
Most of the people on the streets are women. Since Russia entered the conflict, conscription was introduced here. And while the DPR militias have majority support, I've heard of some men who stay in their apartment 24/7 so as not to be forced to join.
Now, to my knowledge, there are no English-speaking mainstream journalists here in Russian-held Ukraine. I think there's a French, a German, an Italian, but that's about it. So in terms of journalists from NATO countries, there's almost none. And the problem with that is that people living in NATO countries simply don't hear the views of people here in Donetsk.
The first thing I would like to say is that the DPR exists because we are free people. We want our own opinions, our own independence and our own views of the world, not the viewpoint that someone imposes on us. So we are defending our interests. That's why the DPR exists.
The majority of people here are Russian speakers with a proud Russian culture. A bust of Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, stands outside the drama theatre. And in the main square, Lenin.
In 2014, I was in Kiev covering the Ukrainian revolution or coup, whatever you want to call it, where I witnessed the pulling down of a statue of Lenin by Ukrainian nationalists. Now, if the Donetsk People's Republic didn't exert control in this area, this statue here most probably would have been pulled down by Ukrainian nationalists as well. And it's statues like this, symbolic statues like this, that are important to people's culture here.
Since the nationalistic Ukrainian government took power in Kiev in 2014, they have attempted to impose their agenda on the majority Russian areas, pulling down statues and forcing institutions to drop Russian as an official language. There has also been the killing of dozens of pro-Russian activists. This is what led to Donbass rising up and attempting to create a breakaway state.
Certainly the rights of the Russian-speaking population were stomped on. There were demands that we should speak Ukrainian and not Russian, and all administration procedures were changed to Ukrainian. I think that any culture should be looked after and passed on to young people. It's very important because young people cannot grow up without their culture. There cannot be any people without their culture.
Of course I was born here. This is my land. I studied here at the Institute. We studied both Russian and Ukrainian. It was normal. And when they started to kill us, we couldn't understand how it could happen, how people can treat their compatriots like this. We are constantly being killed from morning to night here.
The flags of Donbass and Russia side by side. While at first demanding autonomy, since the war, they are adamant they want to be independent or to join Russia. President Zelensky recently said that negotiations are the only way to end this conflict. If lasting peace is to be made, the rights, culture and wishes of the 4 million people here in Donbass need to be taken into account. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The petrochemical complex of Augusta Priolo is a vast industrialized coastal area in eastern Sicily, which includes one of Europe's largest oil refineries, the ISAB plant. This refinery processes about 14% of Italy's crude, about 10.6 million tons a year, and exports in dozens of countries around the world. Owned by the Moscow-based company Lukoil, the ISAB refinery has been forced to rethink its supply strategy as the EU is aiming to get rid of its dependence on Russian energy following the conflict in Ukraine. Since lenders and oil companies have stopped providing financing and crude to Lukoil after Brussels imposed sanctions on the Kremlin, the ISAB refinery is only left to rely on supplies from Russia.
Although Lukoil is not under sanctions, banks and insurance companies prefer not to work with Russian ones. Lukoil can only process Russian crude. That's why, in order to keep the company running, the import of crude oil has increased significantly in Italy.
Moscow has exported about 450,000 barrels per day of crude to Italy in May, more than four times as much as it did before the start of the conflict in Ukraine, and the most since 2013. Rome may soon become the EU's largest Russian crude importer. This despite Brussels urging all members of the bloc to cut ties to Russian energy.
Some unions and think tanks have warned that a total Russian oil embargo would have the immediate effect of shutting down not only the ISAB refinery, but also other large petrochemical plants and many smaller companies in the area.
Energy analysts have noted that Russian crude exports are